This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. We are now less than 3 months away from the midterm elections, and analysis shows there's been a record-shattering amount of money spent in this year's governor's race in Colorado, much of it by the candidates themselves.
We want a democracy in which our elected leaders are not all millionaires.
We'll get a closer look at the trend of wealthy candidates giving to themselves and whether anyone who isn't a millionaire can even run for governor anymore.
States like Colorado and Wyoming produce a lot of natural gas, and while there are jokes that can be made about that, much of that gas flows away long before it can be used, and that's a problem for people and the climate. Enter the scientists.
This is the site of a sort of treasure hunt for you.
Yes, the treasure being methane emissions.
So pirates probably not excited, but hey, we are. We'll take a look at how researchers are working hard on new ways to find natural gas leaks.
Plus, we'll get a review of Skate Kitchen from film critic Howie Mofsovitz and a lot more.
But first, it's hard to believe it, but it's already that time of the year. School is starting up around Colorado. At the beginning of the summer, we asked teachers through our Curious Colorado webpage about what they do to make ends meet when they're not in the classroom. We received many interesting answers, including one from Sarah Weeks. She's been a teacher for over 10 years in Fort Collins.
Maya Angelou said, "My mission in life is not merely to survive, but to thrive, and to do so with some passion, some compassion, some humor, and some style." I'm discovering that this quote captures the essence of my philosophy of life and my career as a professional educator. When I left Arthur Anderson and the corporate world for education, I knew that would mean I'd have to hustle to find additional ways to supplement my income. Even with a master's degree and a Colorado professional teaching license, I still make less money than my husband, who works in supply chain for one of our local breweries. Over my summer break, I worked like usual. 2 weeks on extended school contract and tech support, and 1 week of summer school at STEM institutes. Essentially, I work as a K-5 tech teacher and STEM coach, which allows me to combine my jobs and passion for education. I hope to inspire our next leaders to become inventors, explorers, microbiologists, computer programmers, nurses, and even teachers. But moreover, I want to start a new generation of problem solvers on the right foot, to becoming lifelong learners who follow their passions. These are the reasons why I keep hustling, even though my retirement is unsure, and why I continue to care about my kids and our families, even when the state underfunds our schools. I work into June, a week after our students are out, and then I'm back to work a week before most teachers in early August. I also continue to build my online fitness and nutrition coaching business and our eBay side business. Although I slow down my online coaching business during the school year, I pick it right back up even before classes end. I'm hosting my accountability groups in my challenge tracker app. I'm sharing my obesity survival story publicly. I support goal attainment by exchanging texts, emails, and calls with all the incredible people I coach. To help grow this business, I attended a 4-day professional summit with over 20,000 other fitness and nutrition coaches in Indianapolis in late June, which was super inspiring. Before I left for Coach Summit, I taught Minecraft Summer School for 1 week, and then I had some free time in between all that. I coached some more, I planned for the next academic year, and then I had fun with friends and family in Indiana, North Dakota, and Canada. I also gardened, read books, practiced yoga, and spent quality time with my husband and dogs. My story is one of working year-round to thrive, not just to survive at juggling life's responsibilities and expenses. Yeah, I must work a few jobs and continue formal education to make ends meet, but this is not unique in my field as a professional educator. Just like many other workers, state-certified teachers continually develop their skills through ongoing education, often on their own time and expense. License renewal alone is $90, and teachers typically spend their own money on some student supplies, celebrations, incentives, and stuff like that. Fortunately, my coaching business offsets some of these financial needs and allows me the flexibility to tackle my demanding teaching job during the school year. I consider myself one of the lucky teachers because I work in a school where I'm encouraged to develop professionally and personally as a leader. Some of the same personal development books recommended in the coaching world are also helpful at my school, where we practice a version of Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. I am so fortunate to work with colleagues who are also lifelong learners. I get to teach incredible kids at Lopez Elementary, a Leader in Me school in Fort Collins. I'm really looking forward to seeing my students next week because they're the ones who inspire me to stay healthy and fit and to keep learning. They always have the best stories after summer break, which makes for great learning connections and something to build on the whole school year.
That was Sarah Weeks. She's a K-5 media specialist and STEM teacher in Fort Collins. Her essay was produced by KUNC's Stephanie Daniel, and you can find more of her stories at kunc.org.
In the midst of another hot, dry summer, Colorado farmers are looking to stretch their dollars and their water even further. Researchers with the USDA were recently in Greeley to show off their latest technology. KUNC's Esther Honig went to check it out.
In front of a lush cornfield, a small crowd gathers to watch a white drone lift off. Kendall DeYoung is an agriculture engineer at the USDA's Water Management and Systems Research Unit. He says drones with both a camera and a thermal camera can help farmers more precisely water their crops. It has many wondering if future farmers will be flying drones.
That's funny. I get asked that question a lot.
He says probably not.
But I do envision, for example, agronomists owning them and having it as a service where they could map your fields from the sky.
That's why Colorado Republican Senator Cory Gardner, who was at the event, has pushed for fewer regulations so farmers can have better access to the technology.
I jokingly said you had to be a 747 pilot to be able to fly a drone over a cornfield.
For many Greeley farmers, this is a busy time of year. But Kendall DeYoung hopes they'll take the time to check out their research and share their ideas and concerns that could lead to future research projects. For KUNC, I'm Esther Honig.
When it comes to spending ahead of the November election, Colorado's race for governor is unlike any other. The candidates are wealthy, and they've shattered all previous records for giving to their own campaigns. That led us to this question. Can someone become governor if they're not a millionaire? KUNC's Michael DeJoanna has more.
I think campaign finance is complicated to most people.
Meet Steve Bowie. He's on the front lines of this year's governor's race. It's his job to track the millions of dollars flowing into the campaigns of Republican Walker Stapleton and Democrat Jared Polis.
There are a few of us that work here at the Secretary of State that live and breathe campaign finance every day, so we enjoy it, but you know, it is a complex and intimidating subject matter.
Campaign finance, this is Chris.
Bowie oversees a bullpen of people. They answer phones and help candidates get their paperwork right. He says there are a lot of contributions that candidates cannot accept.
Contributions from other candidate committees, independent expenditure committees, which act independently of candidates and do not coordinate with candidates, cannot make direct contributions to those candidate committees. And corporations and labor unions are not allowed to directly contribute to candidate committees.
And then there are limits for what people can give, which is no more than $1,150 to a campaign. But when it comes to the candidates themselves,
there actually are no limits to what an individual can contribute to their own campaign.
Leading up to the Democratic primary for governor in June, a moderator at the 7 News Denver Post debate asked about that.
Mr. Polis, I want to give you 30 seconds real quickly here. Will you agree to any cap on your own personal spending in this election?
You know, when I started this race, I wanted to spend the time hearing from actual Coloradans, not millionaires and billionaires. We've had over 200 free meet and greets in every corner of this state. And to me, that says a lot about how campaigns should be run. Candidates shouldn't be forced to either be wealthy or spend time with 10 millionaires at a Denver steakhouse every night trying to raise the funds they need to compete.
But Polis, who made a fortune in business, is one of the wealthiest members of Congress, and he has not capped his spending. Of the $13 million his campaign has raised so far, the vast majority of it comes from his own earnings. Moreover, he won't accept more than $100 from anyone. He says his campaign would be happier if people give just $5 to, quote, deliver a message to our opponents that access to political power belongs to all Coloradans, not just the well-connected.
I really give them that in fact, they do avoid the pressure of special interest money where a contribution, it seems, they think it occurs an obligation.
That's Democrat and former Colorado Governor Richard Lamb. He served from 1975 to 1987.
But I do think that the new problem that arises then, does politics become just a playground of the rich? We have a great interest in not becoming an oligarchy where the amount of money that you have or inherit is the biggest political asset that you have.
The money goes to TV ads, social media posts, consultants, all working to sway voters ahead of and on Election Day. Still, that's no guarantee a candidate will win. In fact, the opposite may be true. Denise Roth Barber is the managing director of the nonprofit National Institute on Money and Politics, also known as followthemoney.org.
Candidates who fund themselves in the main, you know, we observe that they lose primarily.
Case in point, Republican businessman Victor Mitchell. He invested about $5 million of his own money in his bid for governor, but he was trounced by Walker Stapleton during the primary. To stay competitive, Stapleton responded with more than $1 million of his own money.
We were forced into my having to do that or make a decision to do that, and I was fortunate to have the ability to do that because of the massive personal spending of Victor Mitchell, my opponent, in the last couple weeks of the campaign. And we were concerned that if we didn't get our message out, that it would negatively impact us.
We want a democracy in which our elected leaders are not all millionaires.
Caroline Fry is outreach director for Colorado Common Cause, a nonprofit that advocates for open government.
We want a wide swath of Americans who are representing us in office. You know, farmers and tech workers and veterinarians and folks from lower income backgrounds.
Democrat Donna Lynn billed herself as that kind of candidate. She waited tables in college and worked her way up to become a top health executive before Governor John Hickenlooper appointed her as lieutenant governor. But the $1 million she raised didn't seem to be enough. Here's Lynn at the June debate.
The most qualified candidate, which several newspapers have declared me as well as our governor, who said I would be a great governor, isn't necessarily the person raising the most money. It also has to do with the fact that I actually am working. And so the time that has to go into raising money, campaigning, is pretty onerous.
Caroline Fry says one solution to this would be to level the playing field in a system where elections are publicly funded.
It gives folks who are more lower income and working class a way to break in and be able to fund their race by talking to members within their community and trying to get small donations that are then matched or increased in some way by a public pot of money.
That idea, at the moment, it's not on the table in Colorado. But there is a provision in the state constitution, Amendment 27, passed by voters in 2002. It aims to reduce the influence of money in state politics with
voluntary spending limits.
Again, here's Steve Bowie with the state's campaign finance division.
That is actually the only restriction in Colorado that places some sort of limit on the amount of money an individual candidate can contribute to their own campaign.
Think of it as a ceasefire for fundraising.
I mean, I think probably the biggest perk, arguably, is public perception that, you know, they're going to run a small campaign. It's going to be grassroots. They're not going to spend a lot of money.
The provision caps spending at about $3 million for a gubernatorial campaign. That's an amount essentially on par with what candidates have spent in previous elections. In a statement to KUNC, Jared Polis said that accepting those limits would be like, quote, disarming in a war zone when outside groups funded by people like the Koch brothers are pouring millions of dollars into our elections. Walker Stapleton blamed Polis for not agreeing to the limits.
That, in theory, makes sense. It's just, how do you get everybody to abide by it and everybody to play on a level playing field? Because clearly somebody who has the resources, unlimited resources in the case of Jared Polis, is going to want to put himself in the best, in his campaign, in the best position ever to win.
None of the major candidates in this election cycle have agreed to voluntary spending limits. KUNC also looked at campaigns going back to 2006 when they were first enacted, and zero major candidates, Democrat or Republican, in a general election has ever agreed to those limits. For KUNC, I'm Michael DiOanna.
Voters may get a chance to address the influence of wealthy candidates this November if something called Initiative 173 gets onto the ballot. That would up the amount candidates could accept in contributions if their opponent invests more than $1 million of their own money. Now, both Stapleton and Polis told KUNC they support the initiative. The Secretary of State's office is verifying signatures that supporters turned in on the issue.
For those that are starstruck, you might think you have to be under the bright lights of Hollywood to be discovered, but that's not the case these days.
If you'd said to somebody 10 years ago you could make a living as an actor in Albuquerque, nobody would have thought that was real, but it's certainly true today.
Some Colorado TV and film producers are banking on the attraction of non-traditional locations to keep talent local.
Now, before you start hunting for a talent agent, hey, Carly, I see what you're doing over there.
How did you even know?
I just know these things. Before we get to that, states like Wyoming, Colorado, and Utah produce a lot of natural gas, but many energy facilities tend to lose that gas due to leaks. A recent study showed they're leaking much more than previously thought, in fact, but leaks can be hard to detect. So scientists are working to come up with a better way to track them down. KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle reports.
Last year, residents of a subdivision in Firestone, Colorado, watched as a home suddenly caught fire and exploded.
The remains of two people have been pulled from the rubble of this house explosion in Firestone.
Two people died, and one was critically injured. The culprit was methane. It's the main ingredient in natural gas, and it had been seeping into the home's basement from an old pipeline.
It would appear an unusual and tragic set of circumstances occurred here.
Yes, tragic, but not necessarily that unusual. Turns out, methane leaks are happening all the time. They usually happen at oil and gas facilities rather than in people's homes. The gas is highly flammable and a potent greenhouse gas. In some ways, it's considered worse than carbon dioxide. It also contributes to smog. But here's the problem. It's colorless and odorless, which means a leak is hard to detect. Sean Coburn is a chemist at the University of Colorado, and he says these types of leaks are also very quiet.
It's not like you can hear. It's almost inaudible.
Coburn is standing in an open field in Fort Collins, Colorado. It looks like some kind of steampunk playground with wellheads, tanks, pipes.
This is the site of a sort of treasure hunt for you.
Yes, the treasure being methane emissions.
It's a testing ground for scientists made of decommissioned equipment, and it's designed to purposefully leak small amounts of methane. Coburn and his colleagues don't know where the leaks are, but they've set up a very special laser to find them.
We can go over and have a look.
So we've got a tripod with a PVC pipe and a mirror inside.
Yeah.
About half a mile away, a laser is shooting thousands of wavelengths of light across this field. Methane interacts with the laser light differently than air does.
And that's how we collect the methane concentration data.
Then, based on things like wind patterns, they can figure out where the leaks are to within about 15 feet and how much methane is escaping. Coburn says the method is incredibly sensitive.
If you were exhaling methane, we could detect your breath from more than a kilometer away easily.
It's a promising new way to detect the gas.
Yes, it is promising.
That's Arvind Ravikumar. He's a postdoctoral researcher at Stanford University studying methane detection.
It looks very good in the sense that it can monitor continuously and it can detect very small leaks from far away.
Which, he says, is a big deal. Right now, the typical method for detecting leaks is to have someone walk around a site with a handheld infrared camera. Other methods involve driving around sites or flying over them with planes or drones. Problem is, with those methods, you can miss a lot of leaks, even big ones, because they tend to happen unpredictably. This laser setup, on the other hand, could sit around for a while, screening constantly. Problem solved. But
there's always a but.
And Ravikumar says in this case, a big one is cost.
The deciding factor will always be cost.
Can the cost come down so much that oil and gas companies would actually consider using the technology in a big way?
That's the ultimate question.
It's hard to say if this new laser method is cost competitive with less thorough leak detection methods. It depends on the site and how often it's required to check for leaks. But it's in the ballpark. And regardless, Ravikumar sees it as part of a positive trend. Researchers and startups are quickly coming up with new technologies.
The costs for detection are rapidly coming down. And so going forward, there's really not that much of an excuse to not do this more rigorously and try to reduce emissions as much as possible.
Ravikumar is hopeful. He says this is one problem that's solvable, and a solution appears to be on the horizon. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle.
KUNC is a member of the Mountain West News Bureau, a regional reporting collaboration. You can find more stories at KUNC.org.
Colorado is a long way from Hollywood, but when it comes to television and commercials, it's getting a lot closer. KUNC arts and culture reporter Stacey Nick has more on the effort to get Coloradans more exposure in the industry.
Even if you don't know Annie Hamilton's name, you're likely familiar with her work.
So just give me your name and age into the camera.
Roe Carney, 16 years old.
16. And what school do you go to?
Fort Collins High School. I'm going to be a senior.
For almost 30 years, Hamilton has handled casting for many of the television and film projects made in Colorado, including, most recently, the Jane Fonda Robert Redford Netflix film, Our Souls at Night. Today, Hamilton is conducting an open casting call for a brand of actor that is becoming more and more sought after in Colorado, real people.
We're steering away from the, you know, beauty and skinny. They want real because that's who the consumers are. That's who their audience is.
More than 50 people showed up to audition with ages ranging from 18 months to 80, some with zero experience, like Deb Coyote, a 58-year-old grad student from Wellington.
And have you done theater or commercials or film?
I've done theater years ago, so community theater.
We constantly struggle to find sort of local people who want to perform on camera.
Doug Usher is the creative director for the VIA Company. And while the Fort Collins-based production agency has created commercials and video projects for companies around the world, they like to hire local when they can.
And because the budgets are really very small locally, generally speaking, it's hard for me to find $1,000 or $2,000 a day to pay an actor when my whole budget might only be $3,000 or $4,000. So today I was just looking for let's open the floodgates and see who's out there that maybe wants to act.
Like 49-year-old Orlando Baker.
You were in Bill and Ted's?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, in yeah, L.A.?
In the mall scene, in the auditorium scene.
Now living in Fort Collins, Baker does everything from landscaping to building bike racks. But before coming to Colorado, he spent time in Arizona and Hawaii, working as a background actor for projects like the film Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and the TV show Lost. He says he knows opportunities like those won't be as likely here, but as Baker fills out a casting sheet outside the audition room, he says it's all about being open to the possibilities.
I guess it's just a matter of whatever is available or open, because it's hard to be specific of what you want because the industry is so flexible. I've got to be kind of flexible to get into wherever they want you, so it's all good.
To director Doug Usher, this casting call is the first step toward bringing more productions to the state, and especially to Northern Colorado.
It's mostly restricted to like Denver, Boulder. We don't see a ton of it come to Fort Collins. And unfortunately, when we do get it here, they tend to bring people in from those bigger markets. They're not hiring our local. And that goes for the crew, too. Like, they're not hiring our local crew or our local talent as much. And so what I'm trying to do is shift that paradigm a little bit to kind of make an awareness that there is resources here.
Eventually, Usher hopes to create an online database where production companies can access local actors along with local crew members. Everything from camera operators to score composers.
My hope and my goal is to get people who are talented to stay, to not feel like they have to leave to go to New York or California to work, that you can have a successful career, you know, in the arts in Colorado if you want it. That's the, you know, the dream anyway.
And while that idea might sound far-fetched, Usher says all you have to do is look to markets like New Orleans and New Mexico.
If you'd said to somebody 10 years ago you could make a living as an actor in Albuquerque, and nobody would have thought that was real, but it's certainly true today.
And to Roe Carney, the 16-year-old from that earlier audition, that's enough to fuel his dream.
I mean, being in film especially is just like a dream come true of mine, and being in front of like the camera, it'd just be just a dream come true to see what I used to watch as a kid, and just me being in it would be awesome.
Very good. Well, that's it. Thank you awesome. So much. Yeah. You did a beautiful job. I appreciate it.
And that's a wrap. For KUNC, I'm Stacey Nick.
The new movie Skate Kitchen is about a group of young women skateboarders in New York. KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, says the film gives a rare and generous view of its young women characters.
On the face of it, Skate Kitchen is typical stuff. An 18-year-old girl takes a short walk on the wild side, which finally isn't all that wild. It's like the old Chuck Berry song. After her quick fling, Sweet Little 16 has to change her trend and be Sweet 16 and back in class again. But along its way, its sense of place and character and its richness of feeling makes Skate Kitchen an elegant, touching movie. Camille Rochelle Vinberg lives with her mother in a working-class suburb on Long Island. The mother mostly speaks Spanish, but Camille, who's assimilating, mostly uses English. It's summer, and Camille spends her time at a skateboard park until she has an accident, cuts herself down there, she tells friends later, and Mom extracts a promise that Camille will give up riding her skateboard. Forever, apparently. But of course she does the opposite. Camille lowers her skateboard by rope out her second-floor window, hops the train into Manhattan, and sets up something of an alternative life for herself with a set of young women skateboarders her own age. These girls have a tougher city vibe than Camille, and their company makes her feel just a touch independent from the control of her mother. Camille uses the ancient teenager ruse that she's at the library, and she texts old photos from the library to her mother to prove it. Camille explodes into her new freedom. Her face is ecstatic and curious and sometimes pensive or doubting. She's quiet, and you can see her take in new things and people. She travels down alleys, around big buildings, past city playgrounds and monuments, and she revels in the skateboard parks. Manhattan's a lot more congested than Long Island, but with her new friends, Camille skates across the tricky intersections like a pro. Director and writer Crystal Moselle, with her cinematographer Shabir Kirchner, manages to make the city landscape at the same time constricting and, for Camille, liberating. There aren't any villains in Skate Kitchen. There's danger, there's loss and uncertainty, but what the film shows is Camille growing through the adventures that she seeks and that present themselves to her. She finds that wonderful group of young, independent women instantly. They talk with each other about everything from skateboard technique to tampons to smoking pot to loneliness. They loll about like kittens. Most of them are working class, but except for one brief moment, there's no cliched picture of desperation. Not many parents inhabit the film. Camille has just her mother, and another father in the city walks in on the gang of girls lounging and yakking in the living room, only to ask what they want for supper. His daughter leads the others to cheer for his lasagna. So there's a nice cultural mix. The lasagna-making father's black. The girls are a mix of black, white, Hispanic, and immigrant. The sun shines throughout the movie. The girls are lively, open-faced, funny, and smart. Of course it's a fantasy, but it's a mostly gentle dream about a young woman finding herself. The title was invented by the girls in the movie who have not acted before. It's the name they've given to their group. In some ways, Skate Kitchen feels like the TV series Girls. Those characters are older than these teenagers, but more important, Skate Kitchen doesn't feel like it has anything to prove. It's not out to show how daring it is or to see how many television taboos it can break. For the most part, it's not hard to tell where the film's going, but it unfolds with beautifully natural rhythms, and it treats these young women with great respect. In 2015, director Crystal Moselle made the documentary The Wolf Pack about five brothers whose parents had kept them locked away from the world for many years. Moselle has a fine, sympathetic eye for young people. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
Oh, one last thing before we take off. The Denver Botanic Garden's beloved corpse flower may be getting ready to do its thing again.
Ugh.
Horticulturists are predicting the rare bloom to occur in early to mid-September. Now, the 18-year-old plant first bloomed 3 years ago, and it was a huge event.
The flower gives off a certain smell that closely resembles that of rotting meat. So you have to wonder, why would anyone want to get up close to it?
No idea.
Well, during Bloom Watch, about 3,000 visitors a day came to see and, of course, smell the plants. So what do we know?
I mean, clearly nothing.
I guess not.
This has been Colorado Edition.
Our show this week was produced by me, Carly Huckles.
And me, Erin O'Toole. Editors Ashley Jeffcoat and Brian Larson contributed to our show. Ashley also manages digital. Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana.
Other music in this episode, Forest Robots, Mandelbrot's In Winter, Robbie Reverb with High Altitude Cocktails, Broke for Free, Nothing Like Captain Crunch, and Art of Escapism with End of an Hour. Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. We'll be back next week with more great stories for you.
Find Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.